Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee to order. We'll start with a roll call.
Johnson.
Here.
Lomer.
Here.
Elstrom. Beckerfin.
Here.
Beckerfin.
Here.
Considine. Dean.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Russell.
Here.
Howe. Lucero. Newberger. O'Neill.
Here.
Pinto.
Here.
Uglum.
Here.
Ward.
Here.
Zerwas.
Okay, members, first bill up today is House File 3505. Representative Anderson. Representative Hills, from every minute, have you had a chance to read the minutes?
I have here. Mr. Chair. I would do it.
Okay, Representative Hills moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes have moved. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know where the bill is going to go? Or you?
I will move the labor bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'll be very brief. I have a couple of testifiers to speak to this bill. What we are doing, in essence, is we are trying to get at the issue of organized retail theft. And with me today, I have Chief Bud Shaver, and if you want to speak to the bill.
Good morning. If you could state your name and then begin with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Bud Shaver, and I am the police chief for the city of West St. Paul. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this morning about this important legislative proposal. I would also personally thank Representative Anderson for carrying this bill. We all know theft crimes occur with considerable prevalence. In fact, the FBI's Uniform Crime Report classifies this theft as a Part 1 crime or a serious crime because of its prevalence. Theft crimes occur every day across our state in every community, both large and small. My community, like many communities in the metro area and those of greater Minnesota, have a concentration of retail. As a result, we respond to a larger number of theft-related calls. In fact, in West St. Paul, with a population of only 20,000, our police officers responded to over 1,200 theft calls in 2017, and those were just the calls that we were made aware of. This equates to 3 to 4 theft calls a day, every day, all year long. A brief analysis of those individuals arrested shows the average age of a shoplifter is 35, and the average value of goods being stolen is about $400. So these are not young kids stealing bubblegum, just under the gross misdemeanor amount. Not too long ago, we had arrested an individual having 123 prior and open theft cases, but because of the value of the items he took that day, he could only be charged with a misdemeanor. In addition, I personally spoke to another arrested individual who professed stealing was his job. He was careful to steal less than $500 because, as if caught, he would only be charged with a misdemeanor. Our analysis also indicated court leniency on misdemeanor-level crimes. While incidents of theft continue to cause a drain on policing resources and consume court calendars, they also increasingly affect the profitability of stores our communities are proud to have lining our business districts. Unfortunately, the cost of theft is passed on to all consumers, while those who do the stealing seem to evade accountability. This bill will not stop the crime of theft, but it would take the critical step of increasing penalties for repeat theft offenders and those involved in organized criminal theft enterprises. With the exception of theft, throughout our statutes there are increasing penalties for continued violations. One could even lose their driving license should continued minor infractions occur. This bill would place the appropriate level of accountability on those who continue to do the stealing. I'm kind of a numbers guy, so I've analyzed some of our costs in prosecuting theft, and in many cases it would be cheaper if my officers responded, would in fact buy the item for the person that stole it, give them a $50 gift card, give them a ride home, I think we'd be money ahead rather than have that person go through the court system. So, Mr. Chair, committee members, again, thank you for your chance to talk with you today about this important legislation, and I will stand for any questions the committee may have. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, is there a reason that you picked on line 2.22 to create this felony on the 25th, because there would be 24 prior convictions? Is there a reason that you picked that number?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom, too. Yes. We didn't want the bill language to be overly punitive, and we want to make sure that it passes constitutional muster, and so that's why it's the high number that you see here in the bill. Mr. Chair, I do have another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I want to ask the same question about 2.32, the elevation of misdemeanor to gross misdemeanor after only two convictions. It feels like I understand the jump up to the 25th conviction to a felony, but then having it be only the third jumps up into a gross misdemeanor. I don't know if Representative Anderson could comment on that and might be open to that number being somewhat higher, given that right now it's unlimited misdemeanors. Maybe it would make sense to have that middle number be somewhat higher than two. But just want to get her reaction, maybe the chief's.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pinto. Happy to work with you on this issue. Welcome any suggestions that you have. So, thank you.
Representative Anderson, go ahead and you have another testimony.
I do, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bruce Newstead. I work for the members of the Minnesota Retailers Association, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear today on House File 3505. As the Chief said, actually, it's an important bill for retailers and law enforcement. Organized retail crime today is a problem. As the Chief said, in fact, of our members, over 80% have reported an increase over the last year in organized retail crime. Now, part of that is organized retail crime looks different today than it did in the past. We don't talk about syndicates and the mafia today. Organized retail crime, thanks to some of the tools available to criminals, looks quite a bit different. And there's a big distinction between somebody who makes an error in judgment one or two or three times and somebody who has chosen this as a career criminal path. This legislation would actually help give law enforcement better tools to work with retailers to combat this problem that exists today. Our research shows that for each of your districts, small, middle, or large-sized retailer, for about $100,000 in sales, there's about $750 in organized retail crime occurring. So it is significant, and as the Chief said, that cost is unfortunately passed on to consumers. So anything we can do to stem this tide, this is a great first step in that direction, and retailers appreciate the partnership they have with law enforcement and your consideration of this bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to sort of follow up on the question about being the third conviction. And I see in the fiscal note that the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is assuming that there would be just 80 misdemeanor theft convictions each year that would become gross misdemeanors. So only 80 people around the state that already have a third or more theft conviction, which actually seems like a really low number to me. I feel like that seems consistent with this note and many more. I just don't know if the testifier could comment on, is it really the case that there would be only 80-some people who would be impacted by this, or would there in fact be more? I'm just trying to understand that.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pinto. Yes, I do think that you're right in your gut feeling on this. I do think that typically on the fiscal note, they tend to be more on the conservative side of things. So, yes, it could be more than that.
And so just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so I guess if that number is higher, which I think it probably would be, then I guess that would maybe reinforce the concern about keeping the number as low as only two prior convictions, just because when you have many more gross misdemeanor convictions, then the impact is not on the state, but it's on the counties, because that's a lot more expensive to have a gross misdemeanor conviction or sentence than a misdemeanor. I think the fiscal note probably is a low estimate, but if that's true, then the impact on our partners in the counties can be a lot higher. So that'd be an idea, a reason to address that number. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank you for bringing this forward. And this became very apparent in a situation that I was made aware of. There's another state representative, and it's outside of the retail realm, so this is why I want to talk about this. He actually hired an online auction to come to his property. And he put on $10,000 to $15,000 worth of property onto an online auction. And the auctioneer, and I won't name the name yet, the auctioneer put, all the things were sold online, virtually. The people came to his property, took all the property away, but all the proceeds went into the bank account of the woman auctioneer. And he received $0 for all of his items that were sold. Now, this didn't just happen to this particular representative. It happened to a widower who had just lost his wife 3 months before, and he was desperate for money since the Social Security was no longer coming to his home. So this same woman did the same thing at his home, and he sold everything that he thought had value on this online auction. All of that money went into the bank account of her business. She sold it online. She kept all the proceeds and said, sorry, I just can't pay you. She didn't pay him a cent. Not only did it happen to the representative and the widower, it also happened to a businessman who was closing down his business. And he had a marine business for his entire life, and he was retiring, and so he had some things left over after he closed his marine business. She did the same thing to him in the tune of over $10,000 that was owed to him. It went into her bank account. So it happened to yet another man who owned a business that was a small little business, and he cleaned windows and things like that. Same thing. Went to his property, sold his stuff, kept all the money. Because we have an online world, this isn't just retail anymore. There are scammers out there that are doing this very same thing, and it is theft. And because it was under the auspices of her business, she has thus far gotten away with it. And yes, there were different police reports filed, and she did this in 4 different counties to victims all over the place. And I couldn't even find all of the victims because some of them were, well, they would bring their items to her retail store that was an online auction, and then she would sell them online. We don't even know how many victims are out there. Could be 100 different victims. She's still doing this today online through Facebook because they have these little, rummage sale or whatever sites where people sell their tables. But this isn't contained just to retail, and I appreciate the retail industry is here. But this is prevalent on Facebook online auctions, and they probably are also going into the retail stores and stealing everything, and they're selling it on Facebook because you see things all the time that still have tags on them and everything else. So we've entered into a whole new world, and I just wanted to thank you because no one was taking any of these victims seriously. Law enforcement they just haven't taken it seriously, and she probably has stolen over $100,000 cumulatively. Now, I don't know where the case is gone. We haven't heard boom from the sheriff's department. It's very sad. But there are victims that I know of, that I found myself, that talked to personally on the phone in 4 different counties. So thank you for doing this, because finally we're taking some of those things that seem like petty here, a little bit here, a little bit there. Oh, we're going to take, some little knickknacks from an old lady, and it's no big deal. But you know what? This is syndicated crime. This is a nefarious, this isn't a mistake. And thank you for bringing this forward, because finally someone is taking this seriously. And I want to thank you. And I just want the committee to understand that we are in a totally different world. This can happen all virtually. And you barely know that it's, out there unless you look at Facebook and these rummage sale sites and other places where they sell these things. And it's more than just eBay, but, there's all kinds of ways to sell stolen stuff now.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So, Representative Anderson, I want to make it clear for the committee so that they understand. So I've actually prosecuted these kinds of theft cases, and so I get that you're doing 24 prior convictions to become a felony if the property is less than $500. But if the property is more than $500, when you make this new gross misdemeanor for the 2 prior convictions, that will also enhance the next level of crime. So if you're over 500 to a felony faster, because you have to have that prior gross misdemeanor to get to that felony. So it does have a ripple effect, and I want members of this committee to know and understand that, which is, I believe, why Representative Pinto was interested in whether it should be two prior misdemeanor convictions or more. So I'm happy to continue to work with you to make sure that these provisions are compatible with where we're going under current law.
Representative Zuwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the bill's on the right track. I think this is a significant issue that impacts all of us. Everything is expensive today as it is because we're paying for other people to take it. And that's just the reality. I spent, after my 5 years with the Anoka County Sheriff's Office, I spent 5 years at Target Corporation in the Target Forensics Lab working on organized retail theft cases, aggregating cases from across the country using latent fingerprints and other technology. At that time, and I've been gone from Target for quite a while, at that time, as a $60 billion a year revenue company, we suffered from about $980 million in loss. $980 million in loss for that year. And my job in the forensics lab at Target was to my team with latent fingerprints, and then another team with video forensics, and another team with computer forensics, would try to link these cases together across multi-jurisdictional, sometimes across states, so that law enforcement could actually prosecute these cases and take them seriously. This goes a huge step forward in elevating the seriousness of closer to reality of what retailers and what us as consumers are dealing with because of the folks that absolutely think of themselves as walking into a Walmart and walking into a Target and taking a Norelco razor or a Dyson vacuum or an Xbox 360 as their job. They steal it as their job, they sell it online, and that's how they pay their bills. And we're all stuck with the tab. So I commend this piece of legislation, and I urge members to support it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ross, Representative O'Neill, thank you for those comments, too. And I do think there are other things that we can do, and I'm certain we'll work with law enforcement. And you, thank you for being co-author on the bill on this as well. There are other things we can do to help law enforcement connect the dots on these things that, again, don't jam up the kid who does something wrong a couple of times that really do help recognize the pattern. And we look forward to working with you and the committee on that in the future.
Thank you. Any public testimony on this bill? With that, I renew my motion to lay House File 3505 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank
you very much. Next, we have House File 3611, Representative Grossel.
Oops.
Representative Grossel moves House File 3611 to re-refer to government operations, and I believe you have a DE amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Yes, I do.
DE1, do you wish to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill into the shape you wish?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grossel moves the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? DE1 amendment is approved. Go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This bill is to prohibit prohibition on disarming local law enforcement officers unless expressly authorized under another section of law. The mayor, city council, county board, or chief law enforcement officer may not disarm peace officer who is in good standing and not currently under investigation or subject to disciplinary action. Mr. Chair and committee, common sense would tell you that you do not disarm your police force, but As to Kurt's recent events, recent statements made, I felt it necessary to bring this bill forth to make sure that some of the things that were stated would not happen. I want to make sure that my brothers and sisters on the front lines in law enforcement have all the tools that they need to do their job and to protect the public. I can go back to my own experiences, Mr. Chair, that 17 years ago, I served as a law enforcement officer. On the 30th day, I was confronted by a man who tried to kill me. He stuck the gun in my face about 3 inches from my nose and was ready to squeeze the trigger. I grabbed the weapon. The first round went past my ear. I still have ringing in that ear to this day. The second round went through my left arm, shattering my humerus. I continued to fight with my right hand to disarm the suspect, and it was not a good situation to be in, I have to tell you. But by the grace of God, I'm still here today. Unfortunately, that man died that morning. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about that and wish it was another way. But my partner was able to stop the threat to my life and bring the attack to a stop. So it's it's sad that I have to bring this bill, but I feel that it is very necessary. So I guess if there's any questions, I'll answer them. But I don't know that there would be.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Grasso. The question that I would pose to you, is there anything that prohibits a peace officer from participating in something voluntarily where they would choose not to carry their gun out in the field with them?
Representative Grasso. Representative Dean, I don't know why a peace officer would choose not to go out into the field without all the tools that they would have at their disposal to serve the public to the best of their ability.
Representative Dean, this bill just says local officials cannot. So if an officer decided not to wear his firearm, that would be his choice.
Sure, I certainly understand that, Mr. Chair and Mr. Grasso. There are many countries throughout the world where officers don't carry guns. They carry other uses of force for situations that they may come across. And I know the conversation is the United States is different. You know, there are over 330 million guns, which is more than the number of people that are, you know, in our country. So you know, I mean, we could have this debate here in committee, or we could just go out and have a drink and a cup of coffee and have the conversation as well. I just wanted to clarify and have it on the record that this does not prohibit any law enforcement, any officers, I mean, specifically it goes to officers, from participating in something where they may not carry their sidearm on them, because this doesn't actually state, you know, an officer could carry a gun in the car and not in their sidearm. So in that given situation, I just think that there's nuance to this conversation, and I understand what your bill is trying to do. I get it 100%. But I just think that a conversation about peace officers, use of force, guns, and other, you know, their sidearms, I think this is a healthy conversation, and I look forward to continuing in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Yeah.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This relates to when they're on duty.
Representative Grasso?
I'm sorry, I'm reading it really quickly here, and I... where does it say? Oh, does this relate to when they're on duty, or... at any time?
This relates to honor off duty peace officers who are in good standing, not under investigation, and not subject to disciplinary action. Representative Considine, a police officer is not off duty. You're a police officer 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. You don't go off duty, actually. As a police officer, I carry off duty continuously, because if I do not have the tools of my trade with me to stop something, intervening in a situation where somebody may be attempting to do someone else bodily harm or great bodily harm, then shame on me for not being prepared to help someone in need.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grossel, I do understand that, in fact, was a co-author of the bill to allow police officers to carry it into the stadium. However, there are, say, a church that would, say, have an objection to an officer carrying into their church. I would say that they would have the right to say that nobody can carry a gun into their church, or there are certain areas where I think that there would be places where they would have the option to say to people that nobody can carry a gun into. And would this overrule their right to say that?
If you read the bill, we still have to honor those places that do not wish you to bring a firearm in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine.
So if a city council had a posting on their city council chamber that said no one is allowed to bring arms into a city council meeting, would that be honored?
Representative Russell? If you're on duty, you don't leave your gun at the door at the city hall. If you're going to a jail or something like that, you have a sally port or a locker to put your weapon in. If you have more questions about this, I'm certainly glad to talk to you about it.
Again, I know that you can. Yeah, I've worked in jail for over 20 years. There's a sally port. You check your weapon. But again, city council meetings have notices posted at the door. You're not allowed to bring weapons into a city council chamber. Would this supersede that?
Representative Grossman, if you're a licensed peace officer and you have your weapon, off duty, you also have your badge with you. So, like I said, you're not off duty. And unless you're under investigation or subject to disciplinary action.
Maybe House Research can answer this question. I believe there's a lot of exemptions for law enforcement. In a lot of places where they can carry. I know we passed a bill last year dealing with the stadium. I think that had...
I was a co-author.
Yeah, but I believe law enforcement has a lot of exemptions on that. Because of the requirement to act 24/7, 7 days a week, whether in their jurisdiction or not, in life-threatening situations.
Mr. Chair, members, most government facilities cannot ban firearms, except for the courthouses and jails. So a city council is not allowed to post a sign unless it's somehow or another affiliated directly with a courthouse. And so it wouldn't apply. And to the larger point of the application of the authority to exclude persons with firearms by private establishments, there's an express exemption for peace officers to that prohibition.
Thank you for the clarification. Thank you.
Dr. Newberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Grassl, for bringing this bill forward. I think we should make every attempt possible to support our men and women in law enforcement. To the topic at hand, I am very grateful that there was an off-duty officer who was shopping in St. Cloud a few years back when we had a terror attack and an individual was running through the mall with a knife, stabbing people. God knows what kind of damage would have happened had that officer not intervened and stopped that situation because he was armed. In addition to that, the city of New Hope had a city council meeting recently, within the last year or two, where an individual came in, he was armed, with full intent of doing wanton damage. And it was the officers in there who responded and saved those lives. Any attempt we can make to stand behind our men and women in law enforcement, this committee should do. Thank you.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was looking quickly through 518B, which is the order for protection statute, and maybe research can answer this. I just want to make sure. So the DE amendment, unless expressly authorized under another section of law, would this apply to officers who are subject to an order for protection that orders that they not have firearms? Because I'm looking through 518B and I'm not seeing specifically, it doesn't expressly say this also includes law enforcement or peace officers.
Mr. Deedle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker Finn, if they were authorized to issue an order prohibiting the person from possessing firearms, I would interpret that to mean that statute authorizes the person not to have the gun. And similar to a Lautenberg issue where the person has a domestic abuse conviction for a misdemeanor, if it's a peace officer, that effectively eliminates the person from being eligible to serve as a peace officer because he's or she is no longer permitted to carry a firearm.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you. Just wanted to make sure because I don't, under investigation or subject to disciplinary action wouldn't necessarily encompass all the situations that 518B and an order of protection applies to since that's a civil process. But it sounds like that would apply. So I just wanted to make sure that we're not doing something unintentionally. I certainly understand the reasons that Representative Grassl has stated for why he wants to do this, but just want to make sure we're not overlooking that piece. So thank you.
Any public testimony on this bill?
Okay, with that, I will Representative Grassl will renew his motion to re-refer House File 3611 to Government Operations.
Thank you.
As amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Representative Franke, next up we have House File 3479. And Representative Franke moves to re-refer House File 3479 to the General Register. Representative Frank, do you wish to move the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I wish to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, and that's to get in the bill the way you prefer?
I will say this, we'll get it in the way that I accept.
Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. And we have the A2 amendment. That's a little bit thicker. Do you wish to move the A2 amendment? And you could
yes,
explain
I would
it
like
briefly?
To move the A2 amendment to keep this in the shape I would prefer.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion approved. Please go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 3479 is our annual scheduling bill of all the new potential drugs and risks that are out there in society put forth by the Board of Pharmacy. This is usually a bill that is more than likely non-controversial, and that's what I had hoped when I received this bill. That was such not the case. There are some sticking points, and thus came forward the amendments. I have provided you with some information on my beliefs on certain areas. There is a new drug out there called Kratom. It is botanical. It is a supplement. It's being used in many different ways, and it's basically an opioid derivative that affects the brain, similar to heroin, but maybe not as effectively. So when I first received this bill, I thought, and started to get some pushback, my first realization was maybe the wrong person was picked to carry this bill. And then I realized, when I look at society and the things that are going on today, maybe the right person was picked to carry this bill. I'm just going to point out some points here because we have addressed, I think, some of the concerns of the opposition to scheduling Kratom or the drugs involved with this new substance called Kratom with our amendment. But I just wanted to let the committee know my views on this after doing a lot more research on this than I had ever hoped but felt the necessity to do. First off, Kratom was started to be, back in the 1940s, I found out that it was grown in Southeast Asia and became a replacement for heroin or opioid addictions. And since then, one of the major countries that produces Kratom has made it illegal. So I think that right there speaks volumes. Kratom, I provided you with a list here that's found on multiple pro-Kratom websites on who has it legal, who doesn't, and how to get around such legalities. So far, countries that have made Kratom illegal are Australia, Thailand, Malaysia, Myanmar. The following countries have not completely banned it, but are under strict control: Finland, Denmark, Germany, Romania, New Zealand. And there are explanations to those laws and laws in other states that deal with this substance. Currently, I believe we have 5 states that have outlawed Kratom, even our neighbor, Wisconsin. Now, in agreeing to the amendment, do I believe personally that this drug should have, or this substance should have been scheduled as a Schedule 1 right now? I can honestly say that I don't. Maybe there are some benefits. I'm not sure, and the data isn't all in. Do I think there is a serious and huge potential for misuse and abuse of this substance? Yes, wholeheartedly I believe that. So I provided you with an email that I got. I've gotten several emails for ProKratom, but the one that really hit me was the one that I provided you from the gentleman that says he became addicted to Kratom. I also provided you with the information on the countries and the states that currently have it. And I'm just going to read you the statement from Scott Gottlieb of the FDA, the commissioner, because I think it kind of sums up where we're at, and I'll try to be as fast as I can with this. But the FDA is concerned about harmful, unapproved products that have been crossing our borders in increasing numbers. The agency has public health obligation to act when we see people being harmed by unapproved products passed off as treatments and cures of serious conditions. Over the past several years, a botanical substance known as Kratom has raised significant concerns given its increasing prevalence and potential safety risks. Today, agency issued a public health advisory related to the FDA's mounting concern regarding risks associated with the use of kratom. Kratom is a plant that grows naturally in Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea. It has gained popularity in the U.S. with some marketers touting it as a safe treatment with broad healing properties. Proponents argue that it's a safe substance, largely because it's a plant-based product. The FDA knows people are using kratom to treat conditions like pain, anxiety, and depression, which are serious medical conditions that can require proper diagnosis and oversight from a licensed healthcare provider. We also know that this substance is being actively marketed and distributed for those purposes. Importantly, evidence shows that kratom has similar effects to narcotics like opioids and carries similar risks of abuse, addiction, and in some cases, death. Thus, it's not surprising that often kratom is taken recreationally by users for its euphoric effect. And at a time when we have hit a critical point in the opioid epidemic, an increasing use of kratom as an alternative or an adjunct to opioid use is extremely concerning. It's very troubling to the FDA that patients believe they can use kratom to treat opioid withdrawal symptoms. The FDA is devoted to expanding the development and use of medical therapy to assist in the treatment of opioid use disorder. However, an important part of our commitment to this effort means making sure patients have access to treatments that are proven to be safe and effective. There is no reliable evidence to support that kratom as a treatment for opioid use disorder. Patients addicted to opioids are using kratom without dependable instructions for use and, more importantly, without consultation with a licensed healthcare provider about the product's dangers, potential side effects, or interactions with other drugs. There's clear data on the increasing harms associated with kratom. Calls to the U.S. Poison Control Centers regarding kratom have increased tenfold from 2010 to 2015, with hundreds of calls made each year. The FDA is aware of the reports of 36 deaths associated with the use of kratom-containing products. There have been reports of kratom being laced with other opioids like hydrocodone. The use of kratom is also associated with serious side effects like seizures, liver damage, and withdrawal symptoms. Given all these considerations, we must ask ourselves whether the use of kratom for recreation, pain, or other reasons could expand the opioid epidemic. Alternatively, if proponents are right and kratom can be used to help treat opioid addiction, patients deserve to have a clear, reliable evidence of these benefits. I understand that there's a lot of interest in the possibility for kratom to be used as a potential therapy for a range of disorders, but the FDA has a science-based obligation that supersedes popular trends and relies on evidence. The FDA has a well-developed process for evaluating botanical drug products, which parties seek to make therapeutic claims, and is committed to facilitating development of botanical products that can help improve people's health. We have issued guidance on the proper development of botanical drug products. The agency also has a team of medical reviewers in the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research that dedicates to proper development of drug applications for botanicals. To date, no marketer has sought the proper development to properly develop a drug that includes kratom. We believe using the FDA's proven drug review process will provide a much more needed discussion among all the stakeholders. Until then, I want to be clear for one fact. There are currently no FDA-approved therapeutic uses of kratom. Moreover, the FDA has evidence to show that there are significant safety issues associated with this before it can be legally marketed for therapeutic uses in the U.S. Kratom's risks and benefits must be evaluated as a part of the regulatory process for drugs that Congress has entrusted the FDA with. Moreover, Congress has also established a specific set of review protocols for scheduling decisions concerning substances like kratom. This is especially relevant given the public's perception that it can be a safe alternative to prescription opioids. The FDA has exercised jurisdiction over kratom as an unapproved drug, and has also taken action against kratom containing dietary supplements. To fulfill our public health obligations, we have identified kratom products on a 2 import alerts, and we are working to actively prevent shipments of kratom from entering the U.S. at international mail facilities. The FDA has detained hundreds of shipments of kratom. We used our authority to conduct seizures, also working with our federal partners to address risks posed by the imports. In response to the request from the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, the FDA has conducted a comprehensive scientific and medical evaluation of two compounds found in kratom. Kratom is already controlled substance in 16 countries, including two of its native countries of origin, Thailand and Malaysia, as well as Australia, Sweden. Kratom is banned in several states, Alabama, Arkansas, Indiana, Tennessee, and Wisconsin, and several others have pending legislation to ban it. We have learned a tragic lesson from the opioid crisis, that we must pay early attention to potentials for new products to cause addiction, and we must take strong, decisive measures to intervene. From the outset, the FDA must use its authority to protect the public from addictive substances like kratom, both as part of our commitment to stemming the opioid epidemic and preventing another from taking hold. As a physician and FDA commissioner, I stand committed to doing my part, preventing legal substances pose a threat to public health, taking grip of Americans, and then it just goes on about his qualifications. So that's kind of where the FDA stands on this. Our own, I have here with me Cody Weiberg of the
Board of Pharmacy.
Board of Pharmacy, and he can speak to it a little bit. I just wanted to let everybody know that I feel that we will be dealing with this in the future. Right now, there is not enough evidence to potentially take this further, but I think we will be coming back to this subject. So with that, I will turn it over to Cody.
Welcome to committee, Mr. Weiberg. Pleasure to have you back again. If you want to introduce yourself and for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Just briefly, the Board of Pharmacy is required by December 1st of every year to issue a report to the legislature in which it reports any scheduling activity it's done. We're not a law enforcement agency. We do have the same authority that the DEA has at the federal level, which is we can, by rule, place drugs into the various controlled substance schedules. We have to issue a report by December 1st that talks about what we've done. We also use that report as a vehicle to let the legislature know about emerging threats. So the issue of kratom has been, or kratom, has been in our report for the last 2 years. We have recommended to the legislature to do one of two things, either place the drug into Schedule 1 or at a minimum make sure that minors are protected. I actually think there is enough evidence to potentially schedule it. The board actually does have the authority to schedule a drug like this by rule using expedited rulemaking if we wanted to, as long as we find certain things. We have to find that the drug is abusable. It definitely is. It definitely activates the same receptors in the brain, the mu opioid receptors that heroin and morphine activate. We have to show that it is abused. You need look no farther than the internet. There are sites on the internet like Arrowhead and Blue Light where people post their videos, and you can find videos of people literally saying they're about to ingest kratom to abuse it, and they're sharing their effects with others. It has to cause people harm. It definitely causes people harm. The Poison Control Center in Minnesota last year saw 18 cases. That's up from 2 just several years ago. As it happens, my first job out of pharmacy school was as a certified poison information specialist at the Poison Center. I can tell you that for every case we got, we estimated there were many more that were never reported to us. We have to show that there is no accepted medical use, and there's a lot of people who want to use it for a variety of things, but there is no generally accepted medical use for kratom. And we have to show that it is not safe for use without medical supervision, and I do not believe it's safe for use without medical supervision. We could have scheduled this. However, we have noted that the legislature has typically dealt directly itself with plant-based drugs. The most you know, biggest example, of course, being marijuana. But there was another plant maybe 5-6 years ago called Salvia divinorum, which the legislature decided not to schedule, but it did make it a crime to possess and sell it. So our recommendation to the legislature was to either schedule it or at least make sure minors don't have access to it, and that's because children are particularly susceptible to the effects of opioids. And so we would have been happy if it had been scheduled, or we were perfectly fine with the amendment, which makes it a crime to sell it to minors, a gross misdemeanor, I believe, and a misdemeanor for minors to possess it. And the last thing I just want to say is you're probably going to hear that, and in fact, the FDA even uses the term botanical. And you may hear testimony that this is just a natural botanical. Well, opium and morphine, then, are natural botanicals because they're derived from the poppy plant. Psilocybin is a natural botanical because it comes from a mushroom, a psychedelic mushroom. And there are examples in the rest of the pharmacy world. Digoxin, which is used for heart disease, is derived from foxglove. The other thing you're going to hear is that kratom is just a member of the coffee family. That's true, but this cup of coffee has nothing in it that's going to activate my new opioid receptors this morning. In addition, there's another family of plants, the Solanaceae family. I can mention four plants in that family: tomatoes, potatoes, mandrake, and deadly nightshade. The first two are nice, edible, tasty food staples. The other two are toxic. So just because you have, you know, two plants in the same family does not mean that if one is safe, the other is toxic. And with that, I'd answer any questions.
Representative Newberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Weiberg. I always enjoy it when you come down here to testify. It kind of puts me in the nerd zone. quick question here. So this is or is not a member of the opioid family?
Mr. Weiberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newberg, it is an opiate. The FDA has done those studies and computer modeling. It does activate the same receptors in the brain that are activated by things like morphine or heroin, so the FDA considers it to be an opiate. At lower doses, paradoxically, there's something in it that causes a mild stimulant effect, but at higher doses, it is definitely an opiate.
Representative Newberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying, it affects the dopamine receptors in the brain, and you're talking about the dopaminergic effect. But what I'm trying to drive at here, is this a Narcan reversible drug? So if someone overdoses on this, as an emergency medical provider, will Narcan treat this?
Mr. Weiberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, in theory, yes, it could. It actually is not dopamine receptors. It's the mu opioid receptors that are activated.
Right.
And anything that would activate those, if someone actually had a sufficient amount of this so that they were having respiratory depression, naloxone should actually be able to reverse that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Final question then. So getting around the nerd talk here, for folks that live in the real world, an overdose of this is no different than an overdose of fentanyl. As far as the reaction, you basically wipe out the respiratory drive and people become hypoxic and they die, correct?
Mr. Weiber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, that is possible, but as Representative Frankie mentioned, different drugs affect receptors different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So the active ingredients in kratom are not as potent as, say, heroin. So it would take a larger dose, if you will, to get someone to that point, but it is possible if someone takes a large enough dose that they would get respiratory depression and that they would need naloxone to have that reversed.
Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is that the reason why you chose the level of crimes that you did? For example, to possess less than 42 and a half grams of marijuana is a petty misdemeanor, and then possession of this by a minor would be a misdemeanor. So I'm trying to get a sense of why you picked the level of penalty that you did.
Mr. Weiberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I didn't. When it comes to criminal matters and penalties, I do not become involved in this. What basically happened this year is staff that worked for Senator Limmer, right before the session, I think just in preparation to see how much workload they had, called me up and asked if we had a scheduling bill. And we only had a couple of other substances, which, by the way, there are other things that we do here. We only had a couple this year, and I actually thought with a short session we wouldn't have a scheduling bill. And I told the staff that, but I said, you know, here's a report from last December. Why don't you give this to the senator? He asked me to draft a bill that would schedule it. And then when it got to judiciary in the Senate, they had received the same pushback, and they had read the report where it said either go ahead and schedule it or at least make it do something to protect minors. So it's actually the Judiciary Committee in the Senate that chose those levels, and why they chose it, I do not know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, and then the next part of the bill that I want to talk about is the amendment that was added, because so far we've talked about this particular provision, but we haven't talked about the entire, however many page, 21 page amendments related to controlled substance and DWIs. And so is this the bill that we've previously heard in this committee that's had full testimony, and are there any changes from the last time we heard the bill related to controlled substances?
Representative Pilstrom, this is the Wills bill that we already have heard. It was put into this bill to match up to the Senate. And David Bernstein is here if you do have questions. Representative Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for both the testifiers. Okay, under this bill on the A1, we're saying that it's a gross misdemeanor for the selling and a misdemeanor for the possession of this very, very dangerous substance, which is an opioid, and we have an opioid epidemic here in the country and everything else. Is there any further research that's going on at the state or at the federal level where we will be revisiting this shortly, perhaps next year or whatever, to look at further limiting this dangerous substance? To either one of you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ugin, I don't know for sure, but The DEA did try to schedule this about a year ago, and the advocates for Kratom, sent in all sorts of comments. About 60 members of Congress ended up asking the DEA to back off. However, the FDA continues to seize products, and the FDA just in February issued this statement that Representative Frankie read. It would not. I don't know. I don't have any pipeline to the FDA. That part of the FDA, I actually am an FDA commissioned officer, but that's to inspect compounding facilities. The fact that the FDA is issuing these sort of statements and seizing products, and that the FDA and the DEA have to work together to schedule it, makes me think that they're going to be revisiting it. I don't know that for certain, but I think they might be.
I certainly hope so. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Uglum, from the research that I've done, the initial concern was put out around August, I think, of last year. Then I'm guessing from what I could tell, lobbyists were hired, letters were sent, and then by October the agencies had backed off. And now I think the concern is starting to come back around, so we're hoping that the FDA and DEA will start to step back up to the plate. So I believe that's kind of the transition and the timeline of where we're at.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pino, Representative Contact, quick question. We do have three more testifiers to go. If these questions for Mr. Weiberg, or we could possibly wait until they ask other testifiers.
It can wait,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frankie, you said there have been 36 deaths associated with it. Has there been a single overdose death associated with this drug?
Representative Frankie.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe there has been any, to my knowledge from the research that I saw, straight up overdose deaths from this. There was an issue with food poisoning, because it's unregulated, and the deaths were a result of that. Maybe Mr. Weiberg could speak more to that.
Mr. Weiberg, Mr. Chair, Representative Consonan, there's a dispute about whether there have been any overdose deaths that are solely related to kratom. There are some reports that there have been, but I think what it is clear is, again, kratom activates opioid receptors, and so if you take kratom with alcohol, if you take kratom with Valium-like drugs, you're greatly increasing your risk of having a severe adverse reaction. And so I think some of the deaths have been the mixed use of kratom with something else like Valium. And if you take Valium alone, you're not going to die of an overdose death. So it's definitely contributed, in my opinion, to overdose deaths, but there's a dispute about whether kratom itself, just by itself, has caused deaths.
Representative President?
Thank you. So the answer is actually no, though.
Dr. Weiberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Constantine, it's not necessarily no. There are some people that believe that there have been straight kratom overdose deaths. It's controversial as to whether or not that's true.
Max, hello. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mac Haddo. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Kratom Association. My mother asked me to tell people I was a piano player in a bordello rather than a lobbyist because she thought that was more respectable. I'm glad to have the opportunity to be here, and I think in my future I see some discussion with Dr. Weiberg about some of the issues that he presented to you. The American Kratom Association fully supports law enforcement agencies having full authority to interdict dangerous substances. In this case, kratom is controversial for a number of reasons. And with respect to Representative Frankie, there are countries that have banned kratom. I think if you look at the record, you find that their regulatory systems are vastly different than ours. For example, in Thailand and Malaysia, kratom is scheduled as a Schedule 5, which is a very mild scheduling in comparison to what we have here in the United States. It is also true that there are economic considerations in the countries where it's grown, because kratom has become a competing crop to the very profitable opioid crop that is used by those countries for export, and so it has some economic considerations as well. But the most important issue that we have in front of us is whether or not kratom is in fact dangerous. It is not. Used alone, it is a very effective dietary supplement or botanical that individuals have the freedom to make choices about their health care, and millions of Americans do. The issue of controversy comes up when we try to describe whether or not kratom alone is the cause of any of the deaths that the FDA has cited. There are 44 that the FDA currently has cited. Every one of them, every single one, with the exception of one, is polydrug related, which means that there are multiple drugs that are taken. If you look at the autopsy reports that have been released by the Food and Drug Administration in coordination with the announcement by Dr. Gottlieb, and we've analyzed each one of them, and we'd be glad to provide you an analysis. It includes deaths like a homicide where the individual was shot in the chest, we think as a result of a drug deal that was going down. And then they did the tox screen. It was a homicide, by the way, ruled by law enforcement agencies, who also was found to have kratom in the system. That is a kratom-associated death. An unfortunate death of a young man who had bipolar disorder throughout his life, who was on multiple prescription medications, hung himself. And when they did the tox screen, they found that he, in addition to the seven other toxic-level prescription drug medications, also was using kratom. Another involves a man who jumped out of the window. This is FDA records. Jumped out of the window in Germany, broke his arm in two places. When they did the tox screen, he died a short while later, refusing medical treatment. And when he died, the tox screen showed that he was also a kratom user. That is a kratom-associated death, according to the FDA. Every single one of the 44 deaths involved multiple drug use, illegal, toxic doses of substances. But the reason that we're here, and the one that does not, the FDA has refused to release any data other than the tox screen. So we don't know what other underlying medical conditions that the individual may have been suffering from. But the real reason we're here, and why you have the six states that have been kratom prior to 2016, is because of what is called the ground zero deaths related to kratom. That occurred in 2009 in Sweden. There were, over a period of a year, there were 12 or 9 individuals who died. The FDA has used those deaths as their basis for all of their subsequent actions, including the import alerts that we referenced earlier, and in promoting to every state pharmacy board and to law enforcement agencies, using the powerful dissemination of information from the DEA and from NIDA, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, saying that kratom is dangerous because of those 9 deaths. There was a report that was issued by Reputable Science, published in a peer-reviewed journal, that looked at what was the cause of those deaths. And what they discovered, that the deaths were all attributable to krypton. Krypton is an internet drug. It is powdered kratom leaves, which has in it a toxic dose of a chemical called O-desmethyltramadol. That's the chemical that's part of tramadol opioid medications that are sold under prescription. A toxic dose of O-desmethyltramadol was in every one of the bloodstreams of those deaths, and it wasn't caused by kratom. Yet, that is the basis that the FDA uses to this day, because in their 44 deaths, they include those 9 deaths. That's what started all of this, and they add to it, and none of those deaths can be attributable only to kratom. Now, there is, I think Dr. Weaver was correct in saying that there is some controversy because some people believe that kratom is associated to an overdose death. Here's the reality. The two alkaloids that are subject to scheduling by the FDA, the way they would like to have them scheduled, are mitragynine and 7-OH. Those two alkaloids do hit the mu opioid receptor in your brain. So, by the way, there are a lot of other substances. It is what happens when it hits it, and kratom, those two alkaloids, are partial opioid receptors. Which, and this is important, it means that it does not affect those opioid receptors the same way that traditional classic opioids and opiates do. It has zero effect from all of the information that's been studied on your respiratory system. What kills you when you take opioids is that your respiratory system is suppressed significantly. Kratom has shown no demonstrable way to do that in any of the scientific studies that are available. Now, it's important to note, too, that Narcan also hits that opioid receptor. It recovers people from that respiratory suppression. That's why it's so effective. So if you go down the path of restricting those chemicals or substances that hit your mu receptors, and they're only partial agonists, then that's a very tricky, slippery slope to slide from. That's where we are today. So the question is, what about kratom itself? If you took kratom, you would gag on it. You can't take enough of it in order to get the kind of high that's been described here. It is terrible. Children wouldn't take it. We fully accept, by the way, the amendment. We think if you want to ban children from using it, they would use it. It's not pleasant. The extracts of some kratom products that are in a liquid form, many of you may have seen those, they're sold in convenience stores, like a $5 energy shot. They cost about $8 a bottle. In order to get any kind of a measurable high or euphoric effect similar to a joint, based on studies that have been done, you would have to consume 380 bottles of that kratom substance in one sitting at $8 a bottle. We don't think there are many people out there that are that dumb that want to find a high at paying $8 a bottle for 380 bottles to drink it all. And it's a terribly tasting thing. You probably would gag before you could consume all of them. So, it is not a problem with recreational drugs. What we have here is millions of Americans who have sought the freedom to use a botanical product. And Dr. Weiberg made the point that you're going to hear that it's just a botanical. The most important point about kratom is that it is available now to individuals who want to use it for make their own decisions about their health and well-being. Some people, a small segment of the population, have found that it's effective to manage their pain. as an alternative to acute or chronic pain. Now, the only choice you have as an American today, if you want to manage that acute pain or chronic pain, is you can use the NSAIDs, like ibuprofen. The problem with that is that ibuprofen and those kinds of NSAIDs cause lots of gastrointestinal issues. There are over 2,000 deaths that occur because of that. Or you can go to prescription medications and opioids, and we know that the outcomes of those are the thousands of deaths too. As a safety signal, the studies have shown that kratom is a far safer than any of the alternative pain management therapies that may be available to people today, to the extent that small segment of the population uses kratom either as a pain management therapy or as a step-down therapy for opioid addiction. So we think the bottom line here is, and I would add one other thing about the Poison Control Center reports. There are hundreds of Poison Control Center inquiries that are made by parents and by individuals to the Poison Control Centers, an uptick from when it first started back in 2009. Absolutely true. There are 3 million calls to Poison Control Centers every year. As a safety signal, it's a very small signal. Most of the calls were people asking, is kratom dangerous? It wasn't that someone was suffering with a health problem. Most of those calls were just inquiries about whether it was appropriate to use it. So the question here, and you have before you a letter from 9 prominent scientists who conclude that there is no basis for any conclusion that kratom will kill you. There is no basis for anyone to believe that it has an adverse impact on the public health, that it presents a risk. There is a reason to study it. And the question about whether any of the federal agencies are doing that today is accurate. There are. Back in August of 2016, when the FDA recommended to the DEA that it be scheduled, kratom be scheduled, there were 23,000 comments that were given. But that's not the reason the DEA failed to act. They heard from scientists who conclusively demonstrated that what I told you today is true, and you have a letter from 9 of those scientists. The members of Congress weren't reacting necessarily to the citizens' complaints. They looked at the science, and the science is clear that today more research has to be done for those uses that are properly dealt with by the FDA, but there's no basis for banning that substance as it is today. And so NIDA is doing studies. These 9 scientists that signed the letter that you have before you today, or most of them, I think 8 of the 9, actually received money, financing from NIDA and other federal agencies for studies like this, and we're going to continue to work with them to do it. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Leave you with the conclusion that you can safely use kratom, that only if you add to it a synthetic chemical that spikes it, like O-desmethylframidol or some other polydrug use with a prescription drug, that's the only time you create the hazard, and it won't be the kratom that kills you, it will be the toxic dose of that other substance.
Thank you. Jennifer Langford.
Ms. Langford, I'm not sure what you're speaking on, but we need to speak the language that's in the bill. So we are discussing the bill, not the effects of kratom, but just what's in the bill.
Okay. I am a concerned citizen because I am somebody who suffers from fibromyalgia and lupus and was on complete bed rest, or not bed rest, but like bedridden. I mean, I was in the process of getting a PCA because I couldn't shower by myself. I needed my husband to help me, and I have 4 children, and I couldn't help care for them. I couldn't even let them sit on my lap because it hurt too much. I had been on many opiates and many other medications for a few years, and they were making my side effects. I had such bad side effects from those medications that it wasn't worth it to take them, so I just got off of those almost 3 years ago. I did research for about 6 months on kratom because I had heard about it. I did research, my husband did research, and he told me to go ahead and try it because I had been trying all kinds of natural ways to help, just to cope. And believe it or not, I wouldn't be sitting here if I didn't have it. I would be bedridden again, and my kids wanted to be here today to come and talk to you because they don't want me sick again. they're scared that I'm not going to be able to join them at school.
And this bill does not stop that from you from obtaining the credit.
From my understanding, it was...
It was amended so it's only minors cannot have it.
Okay, gotcha. All right, I just wanted you to know.
Thank you.
Yep. And I wanted to say, too, that my doctors do know, and they are all in full support. So, just...
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Annette Peters. Again, if you keep your comments in reference to this, to what's in the bill, which is now disbands creating for minors.
Okay.
If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Annette Peters. I'm a registered nurse, 58 years old. I've been a nurse for almost 40 years. And I ended up with some health issues about 10 years ago, an accidental peroxide poisoning in a procedure from surgery. Burned all my internal organs. I was in the ICU. Ended up with chronic pain issues. I was on opioids. I had to file for disability retirement from my job. Could not work from the side effects from opioids. Decided to go off of those. And then did a lot of research about kratom. Started to responsibly look at all the research and start to use it in 2014. And in 2015, I went back to work. It's been very helpful for me. I haven't had side effects from it, and I've been able to contribute and actually lecture at the college, too, for the nursing programs.
Thank you. Any questions from the committees for any of these witnesses? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right, so this is for the bill's author. I'm just wondering if there's a reason that the sale to a minor is it a gross misdemeanor, is maybe building a little bit on Dr. Hillstrom's question, as opposed to a felony. And I'm concerned about escalating penalties in lots of areas, but I also want to make sure that crimes do fit within the broader structure. And I'm just thinking about other controlled substance crimes and just the fact you got selling into a minor, that seems like a pretty significant, so I'm just wondering if there's a particular reason. It sounds like it came from the Senate, but if that might be something you might be open to discussing.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto. Yeah, that language came from the Senate, so we're just amending it to match the Senate. All the stakeholders agree that that language seemed to be acceptable, so I'm sure Martin will discuss it. Thank you.
Dr. Wyward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I have to double check for sure, but I think the level of penalties, I think they looked at what they did with Salvia divinorum, which is another plant, I believe. I'm not 100% sure of that, but that is what, when I was talking to them, like I said, I don't do criminal penalties, but I did remind them that they did, that's how they handled Salvia divinorum.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee members? Any other public testimony? With that, Representative Frankie removes his motion to re-refer House File 3479 to the General Register. As amended, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion approved. On your way to the General Register.
Welcome, Representative Chair Johnson. Would you like to move House File 3610?
Yes, I move House File 3610 to be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Members, this bill comes before you as a concern that I've had over a number of years. When a police officer is assaulted, it's a bad situation. The person that assaults a peace officer will generally assault anybody. Normally, when law enforcement goes into an area where there's a fight or
things are getting hostile. When that uniform shows up, a lot of times just by having that uniform there, things calm down. But when they go after and assault a peace officer, it tells you that they'll assault anybody. And when they assault a peace officer, it's usually the peace officer is in a fight for his life. This bill changes the penalty from a gross misdemeanor to a felony. And I think that's important. I've myself been assaulted a few times. I know Representative Grossel has been. You heard his story. But you know what my story was? I was fortunate. I went in to back up an officer. I had a domestic that was called in as a mother-child domestic. Yes, it was mom who was stood about 5'1". And it was the child who was about 25 years old. 6'2", was described by another officer, if you remember back in the early 90s, the wrestling world. He was described as Jerry Blackwell's twin brother. At the time, I weighed quite a bit more, but he made me look little. I was still one step up from the bottom of the step because the incident, I was told the kid was downstairs. I still had two steps to go to get to the floor, and he did a back kick, which fortunately went over my head. I had enough time to grab my portable radio, which for some reason actually worked in a basement out there, and scream for more help, and the battle was on. Fortunately, I was not injured, but during that battle, my jacket was pulled over my head, so I have limited arm movement, and he is trying to get my firearm out of my holster. I'm swinging around like a sack of wet potatoes, my legs flying all over, not even touching the ground. And I didn't mention to you that he was covered in blood from the assault and to his mother and the other things that he broke in the house and breaking the glass and stark naked, nothing to grab onto. It was an ugly scene. Fortunately, his father and his cousin, who was about the same size as him, and myself and the other officer that was there, were finally able to contain him and bring him down and get him handcuffed and get the medical attention that he's on. He was whacked out on PCP and some other drugs. I was not injured. We only could charge him with a minor offense. He was literally trying to kill me and my partner, and he could not be charged with that because I wasn't injured. This bill changes that. It makes it just assaulting a peace officer a felony, and I believe it is the right thing to do. And with that, I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members?
I think, Madam Chair, I have something, but I know that there's an amendment. If you want to address the amendment first, if that is being offered.
Thank you. I believe the amendment's been withdrawn. Is that correct?
Okay. Thank you. Then, in that case, Madam Chair, I will. And I spoke with Chair Johnson about this beforehand, and I know that the intent of this bill is a very good one. I have charged a number of assaults on officers, and I know it's a reprehensible act. I'm concerned, as I've said to the Chair in advance, that this bill actually might have the opposite effect of what it's intended. And so just to make sure we're all set on this, that assaulting a civilian, and even a pretty severe assault, I mean, beating somebody up pretty bad, is a misdemeanor. Assaulting an officer right now and causing no harm is already an enhanced offense to a gross misdemeanor. If any harm is caused at all, a small, a nick, a bruise, anything, that is a felony already. And again, I'm supportive of that. So again, a little bit of injury is a felony, whereas if it was a severe, it would be a misdemeanor. And that, I think, is an appropriate thing to recognize in the unique role of peace officers. What this bill would do is to increase the penalty for causing no harm to be the same penalty as causing harm. Members will see in the statute that the maximum sentence, the statutory maximum, is different, but the way that this would work in practice is result in the same sentence in virtually all cases, because it already is the lowest level felony can be to cause that demonstrable bodily harm. If more harm is caused, a broken bone or something, it certainly is a more serious felony and should be. My concern is if the penalty is the same regardless of whether harm is caused, then you're really taking away any sort of incentive somebody has to not cause harm. And we talk a lot about whether what kind of incentives different penalties apply, and I think often we can say that they don't. But I just have the concern that if somebody is inclined to shove or kick at whatever it is at an officer, they're going to say, well, might as well cause some harm, because it's going to be the same penalty either way. So I think it's important in our structure as we set up crimes and penalties, we've talked a lot about this, that we have a structure in place where you have a higher penalty if you cause harm, even a little bit of harm. And by removing that, I'm concerned it would actually cause more harm to officers rather than less. And I know that's certainly not the author's intent. We can certainly increase the penalty for causing harm, but then we start bumping up against the penalty for assault 3. We could increase that penalty, and then we start increasing other things, and we start having a really high fiscal cost, and also just increasing things all around. So I do have great concerns this will have the opposite effect of what the author intends.
Chair Denson?
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, I understand where you're coming from, but I also see it this way. If a person's willing to kick an officer or willing to fight an officer, at that point, he's getting in a position where forcing the officer to take action, and if he actually gets into a physical fight with the officer, that if you're fighting an officer, that officer is in a fight for his life, not just for that individual to get away. That's why there's a difference between assault and resisting arrest. When you're resisting arrest, the officer has made that initiation to arrest you. That would not be an assault. And the officer could get injured during the resisting. But when a gentleman comes up and intentionally attacks an officer, who is he not willing to attack? Is my question. He's a danger to the public if he's willing to attack an officer. That's why I think it deserves a higher opinion.
And Madam Chair, and I'll just know that it already is a higher offense, and if there's any injury caused, it would be an even higher offense still. But I understand where the Chair is coming from on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any public testimony on this bill? Anybody from the public? Come on down. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record. And
Naomi Kleonski. It sounds to me, and I would be happy to have anyone in the room deny this, that part of the nature of this bill is an implicit understanding that the value of the life of an officer outweighs the value of a life of someone who's not an officer. Is that correct?
Chair Johnson?
Any life is valuable. There's no one's life is more valuable than any other.
Unless you're in uniform?
What I have seen in my career in law enforcement is if somebody's willing to take the life of a peace officer, they're willing to take anybody's life. They don't care about life. They have no value for anybody's life.
That sounds to me more like you're describing the state of a police officer.
Excuse me, ma'am. Could you repeat your last name? Ma'am? I didn't catch that.
Kleonski.
Kleonski. Ms. Kleonski, the protocol here is to go through the chair. So, Ms. Kleonski, if you have something else to say.
Oh, is it my turn?
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. It sounds to me like the person next to me is describing the actions of a police officer more so than any random person on the street in terms of their willingness to cause harm to any person they encounter.
Thank you. Chair Johnson, would you like to respond?
The value of any life is important. Nobody's more valuable than anybody else. But what this bill does is make a law enforcement officer is there to protect everybody. And if he is not there to protect everybody, nobody is safe. We saw that situation similar to this, how valuable an officer is, just the other day in Maryland, where a peace officer, instead of running from gunfire, ran to gunfire, engaged the perpetrator, and saved how many countless lives. That's what a peace officer is doing there. We need to do what we can to protect our peace officers because they're the ones there to protect us.
Thank you. Representative Ugin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, you know, we can talk about philosophical issues all we want, but I'm really interested in the nuances of the bill and what the young lady feels about the bill itself and the increased fines and increased penalties.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify from the audience? Oh, I'm sorry. You asked me a question? Oh.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Miss Lansky.
Lansky, yeah. It sounds to me like the content of the bill is part of a trend of working to criminalize anyone who has anything on which they disagree with the police.
Madam Chair. To the testifier, well, the bill itself on 1.9, throughout the bill here, the increased fines and penalties, what is your opinion on those specifically?
Okay.
Ms. Kulinski.
What is my opinion on the increased fines and penalties? Can I see the copy of the bill? Is that okay? So... Again, it sounds to me like this would make it more and more difficult for the person who has touched or tapped a police officer to move on with their life and ever come back to a place in society where they're able to function as a regular member of society, because they will go through legal processes that will leave them locked up and without the right to vote for the rest of their life. And I don't see how that's productive to maintaining a peaceful society, which is, from my understanding, the supposed role of a peace officer or a police officer.
Representative
Ward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps it would be helpful for a quick definition of assault.
Representative Chair Hing. Chair Johnson.
I think I'd have to research to get the exact wording. It's been a while since I've had to look at my statute books when I was an officer.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, the definition of assault appears in Section 609.224, Subdivision 1. And an assault is an act that takes place where someone commits an act with intent to cause fear in another of immediate bodily harm or death, or intentionally inflicts or attempts to inflict bodily harm upon another.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Come on here again.
So that would include an officer understanding a hand motion of a citizen or a person that they're encountering to be something that causes, that is a threat, which, as we all know, can be taken extremely out of proportion, such as we saw in California this week, where an unarmed black man who was holding a cell phone was shot by over 20 times. And as we've seen numerous other times with similar cases where people's unarmed hand motions were taken out of proportion and assumed to mean a threat of bodily harm to the police officer. So that sounds like an incredibly dangerous definition of assault and an incredibly dangerous thing to be increasing the punishment for.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, any other folks from the audience that wish to testify? I think there's a gentleman behind you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
My name is Walmer Blue. Thank you for having me, Madam Chair. Chair Johnson. I agree with Johnson. that it should be a felony. Anybody assaulted an officer, that I believe it should be a felony. Just as simple as that, because they're here to keep the peace.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else? Okay. We will re-renew your motion, Representative, or Chair Johnson.
I renew my motion to, on House File 3610, to re-refer to Ways and Means.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign?
No.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 951. I will move to re-refer House File 951 to Government Operations. Representative Dean will move.
Yes. Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to thank a couple testifiers I have here today. Eli Darris with the ACLU and Justice Paul Anderson is also here. I know that the path to get to this point has not been a smooth path, but I want to thank the chair and the members for hearing this bill today. We've also noticed that there's the repealer does something that actually was not intended to do. So I would like to make an oral amendment to remove 5.12 and 5.13. If you'd like, I'll explain really quickly.
Please explain what that does.
Yeah, so the repealer was put in, and it was meant to apply directly to the issue of charges or alleged violations of individuals who were people with a criminal record who were prohibited from voting, from being able to vote. And actually, this repealer repeals the whole section, which was never the intention, because it includes all forms of possible fraud. And if should this bill move forward, that would not be the case for an individual with currently under probation or under supervision. So we'd like to remove that repealer.
I have no problem with that. All those in favor of this motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion adopted.
Right. Well. Thank you. Today we're here to talk about the impact of those individuals that are currently out in the general public. We're expecting them to be good, upstanding citizens, and one of the basic sort of impacts of being a good citizen is actually participating in our voting. We know that people that vote tend to be less likely to recidivate, or in other words, to commit other offenses. So I believe that this is a great bill that would do that. And I also want to, you know, dispel any rumors or any idea about who this bill impacts. Over 60% of the people that will have their right restored, of which currently I believe there are about 47,000 to 50,000 people that currently don't have that because they're still under supervision or on probation. Over 60% of those people live outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County. So this isn't an urban issue. This isn't a rural issue. This is a statewide issue. And those individuals that currently are prohibited from voting, some of them are on 20, 30, I even heard the other day of a 40-year sentence of probation. So I think it's having an impact that we don't intend. I believe that this would be a great public safety issue. And since I know we're running short on time, I'm going to turn this over to my testifier, Eli Goetz.
Thank you, Representative Dean.
Greetings, Chairman Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Eliza Darris. Today I get to use my voice to advocate for myself and for the women and men who are similarly situated like me. Who are we? We are citizens who are your brothers, we're your mothers, uncles, cousins, neighbors, sons, mechanics, and in some cases, campaign staff. And we can't vote. We can pay taxes, but we can't vote. We obey by the regulations, the ordinances, and the laws created by lawmakers, but we can't vote. We live within a representative democratic republic, but paradoxically, we can't vote. For the past two election cycles, I've had the privilege of seeing thousands of those little red "I voted" stickers. Seeing those stickers have actually been bittersweet for me. As an organizer and former field director of a recent mayoral campaign, I was overjoyed to see people push to the polls. Secretly, I hoped that they had voted for my candidate. But on the other hand, every time I'm able to see those little stickers, I'm reminded that though I have likely driven thousands of people to the polls, I can't vote. Though I probably personally knocked 1,000 doors myself and engaged over 1,000 citizens to participate in this democratic process, I can't vote. I have never known the joy of selecting someone to represent my community. As the law stands now, I won't be able to vote until the year 2025. That's when I'm off parole. I'm right here in the community with all of you, right now, in the heart of it. But I am invisible to society in one of the most fundamental ways of being a citizen, a ghost, a non-voter. When I go and I speak to your legislative assistants, you know what the first question they ask me is? Are you a constituent? That's the first question. Translation, are you a voter? How much do you matter? Well, we matter. And I'm here to represent those of us who matter. Our voices matter. Our communities matter. We are here. I urge the members of this committee to pass House 5951. This bill is restorative and it's confirming. This bill would impact 51,000 Minnesotan citizens just like me, a majority of which actually live outside of the Twin Cities. So I'm actually speaking on behalf of many of them who are in rural Minnesota as well. The bill is supported by 70 organizations from around the state, including the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, numerous faith-based groups, and the ACLU, where I now work. We are the Restore the Vote Coalition, and today I'm here on behalf of all of them. It's time to pass this bill. It's an acknowledgement of citizenship. It shifts the responsibility and weight of democracy to more stakeholders. It eradicates the shadows and expands democracy. And I urge you all to support this bill. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The next testifier, we need to be as brief as possible because our committee time in this room will run out in 12 seconds. So we'll go a minute or so longer.
We'll let Justice Anderson address the brevity of his presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I come from a venue where we have people on the clock, so I'll try to adhere to the clock. I'm here because some people think I have something of value to add. And that's my experience in the criminal justice system. I got to tell you right out from the beginning, I believe that it is a just and good policy to restore the right to vote. I have affirmed any number of sentences that are very harsh and long time incarceration and long time parole and probation. When you do that, you're very concerned about the end product of our criminal justice system, which is historically and always been rehabilitation and restoring the citizen to the rightful place in society. I explain that in written comments, which I'll give to you later because I'm fair with your time. But if you are concerned about rehabilitation and getting people back in society, and I do a lot of work in rural Minnesota, and I know a lot of hunters out there and other people who are affected by this bill. They can't be part of, you know, the culture that they want to be because, you know, they take people to vote and whatever. So, why should we do this? It's good policy. It allows us to restore persons to society with a rightful vote. It takes away the stigma that goes with this long time. And this bill is counterintuitive. From the time we start grade school, we are told about the precious right to vote. We are encouraged to vote. It is a unique time in a felon's life when they are under the yoke of the Department of Corrections and under probation. It is a chance to educate them as part of this process what their civic duty is and what their right is and get them to show up and vote. The other counterintuitive part of this is that my colleague on the court, Justice Barry Anderson, likes to refer to three felonies a day. The book that talks about if you're an ordinary professional, when you wake up in the morning, between that time when you go to bed at night, you are probably committing three different felonies. When I started the practice of law, chapter 609 had about 36 pages. It's now approaching and maybe even exceeding 250. We should not have laws that are counterintuitive, and in fact, if someone, a friend of yours, wants to vote and thinks it's their civic duty and shows up, we are causing them to be a scuff law. Finally, I mean, trust me, I have put in my remarks the justification for punishment. I'm not talking about reducing punishment. I'm talking about restoring people to society. I'm going to finish up on this point. After 20 years on the bench, I have come to the conclusion that we are a quite unforgiving society. We're very harsh in what we do, sometimes vindictive. See, judges can do mercy and compassion, but forgiveness comes from society. In my mind, this is low-hanging fruit. When do we start forgiving? We start forgiving at the point that somebody leaves prison. We educate them about the right to vote, and we allow them to vote. And so I'll stand on that. I will submit my written remarks to the chair, and because I found out late yesterday afternoon they wanted me to testify. I started last night about 7, and I finished up at about 2,000 words, so I'll honor you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I will be brief in my remarks. We have seen this bill come before, and we've discussed this a number of times, Representative Dean, and I appreciate what you're trying to do. And I do believe that we should be, take a second look at this, that people that have committed felonies should have the potential to having this restored. However, at this time, as I read the bill, I cannot support this bill because someone has to speak for the victims. Murder is a felony. And when you are killed, you don't get to vote ever again. Murder victims can never vote again. I do not support restoring the right to vote to someone who has taken another person's life. Because when you take someone else's life, you're also taking away their ability to vote forever. If you amend this bill that addresses that portion for felony murder, then you've got my attention. But until then, someone has to speak for all of the people that are in graveyards who do not ever get to vote again. Should we be forgiving and should we take a second look at this? Yes. But until that provision is in this language, I cannot support the bill. Thank you.
Chair, can I have an opportunity to address that?
I'll
be brief.
Mr. Darris?
Yep.
Go ahead.
But Representative Newberger, I can appreciate that position. Certainly, all lives matter and all harm matters. Now, part of what I do within the community is try to reduce as much harm as I can and just make our community safer to live within. But the fact that we just have to come into acceptance with is that even people who have committed murder, myself included, that's what I was convicted of, are out here in society right now. One person who was convicted is testifying in front of you right now. I'm here, and I'm not going anywhere. And there is still a public interest in terms of healthy reintegration. I could be your neighbor next week. I can move in right next door to you if there is a vacancy within the house next door to you. I can be right there. And I think that there is a healthy public interest in making sure that there is a safe and healthy reintegration from people, regardless of what crime they committed, back into society. And I think one of the most fundamental ways of helping to reintegrate someone back into society is having them participate in this civic process, namely voting.
Representative Hoover?
Thank you for your testimony. And as a matter of fact, there are two homes right next to mine, and if you were in my neighborhood,
I don't know if I can afford it,
but you would be more than welcome, because I'd probably ask you to watch in front of the yard when I'm gone. But point being is the argument that you're making, with all respect, Mr. Chair, and to the time, the fact still remains that the victims of murder, they don't get any restoration. They still cannot vote. And once we change this, if you amend this bill to address that issue, then I can. You got me. I'm walking down that path with you towards supporting it. But someone has to speak for the victims. Once you're dead, you're always dead. And that's an immutable fact.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be to the bill author or any of the testifiers. Could you help me understand, are there other rights in addition to voting that are also withheld from those who've committed felonies?
Yes, there are. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, there is, with the conviction of a felony currently in our state. As long as you are under supervision or probation, you cannot vote and you cannot have access to a firearm. So I'm focusing primarily on this, and I know there's been discussions around firearms, and I don't want to get into a firearm debate right now because we're running a little bit late, and we could go 5 hours for that as well. And I'll wait to make some comments relative to what Representative Newberger said in my closing comments. But did you want to say anything, Justice?
I'd like to address something that Representative Newberger put his point. When I was last year on the juvenile bill, Representative Lomer asked what I thought was a wonderful question. She asked the question about what role does hope play in rehabilitation. You said the same thing just a bit ago, okay? Giving hope to some people that they once can be restored to being able to vote, that's going to be very important. I think it'll make people less likely to recidivate. I'm not going to tell you what you should do with felonies, whatever. I know Chancellor Bismarck in Germany said once, if you like sausage, you like legislation. I don't want either being made. Figure out how to get this done. And sometimes you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. But do something about the vast majority of these people that are being disenfranchised in what I consider an unjust way and a counterintuitive and counterproductive way for our society.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you can just nod for trying to be expeditious here. Is my understanding correct that at the end of probation, voting rights are restored?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, yes, and we also made it clear that some sentences are 40 years long.
Can I address that?
This is something that I hate. Mr. Chair, I have a follow-up question.
I have seen so many draconian probations imposed in this state. I mean, I think sometimes somebody's better off to go to jail rather than take the probation. I mean, that's one of the hidden dirty secrets about the criminal justice system. So, listen, it's a good point, but we have some really draconian probation. I'm sorry, but that you pricked a point with me that I've seen too often in our society.
I'll shut up and be quiet. Representative Considine.
Mr. Chair, I have a follow-up. I'm trying to go as fast as I can, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, and that was going to be the point that I wanted to make, is I echo the sentiment of Representative Neuberger. I'm receptive to this conversation. But the fact is, the debt to society equals jail time plus probation. And at the end of the debt to society, which equals jail time plus probation, voting rights are restored. So just those who may not be fully familiar with this legislation and this conversation, which I think is a healthy one, that voting rights are restored, but what this legislation does is seek to restore voting rights prior to the end of the debt to society, restoring voting rights after jail time is completed, where I completely agree with what the Justice just said. I think one of the areas we absolutely need to address and tackle is this excessive 30-year, 40-year probation. Absolutely. And I think if we were to address that and bring those in, you know, reduce those to a more reasonable time period, then I think this conversation essentially will solve itself for the most part. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lucero. When we put this into statute in our state, the restriction of the loss of civil rights and voting in Kansas, there were very few crimes in which people would actually go to prison. I actually believe when this was put in place, there really wasn't even a thing called probation in place. So as our criminal justice system has evolved over time, the original intent of this bill, or the original intent of this law, I think has somewhat changed a lot. So that's why I'm bringing the bill forward today.
Representative Dean? I do have to correct you. It wasn't statute or law that made this rule. It's Article 7 of the Minnesota Constitution, Section 1 in the elective franchise. The following persons shall not be entitled or permitted to vote in any election in the state. A person not meeting the above requirements, I'm farther down in the paragraph, above requirements, a person who has been convicted of treason or a felony, unless restored to civil rights, not right, rights with an S, so all their civil rights do have to be restored before they can vote again. And that's in the U.S., in the state constitution. That's why I have a problem with this bill, because it's a constitutional issue. It's not a legislative issue. And that's what we're going to need to work on. So, I hope you understand where I sit on this issue, Representative Dean.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair, I certainly understand. And although the Constitution spells out what it does, we have since lowered laws and laws on top of laws that actually begin to define what that is. And I think it's through that definition that we have an area for conversation.
Representative Zulak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Dean, for carrying this bill. I'm proud to be a co-author on this bill. I support you and your efforts in this bill. It was 2006, the fall of 2006, when I was running for my first elected office. I was Elk River City Council member, and I was door knocking in Elk River, and person answered the door, and it's a young man I went to high school with. And he had his daughter there, and we spent about 15 minutes talking about how he's been doing, living in the community. Also on the ballot that fall was a voter referendum for the school. And he was talking about his daughter was going to be in school that year, and he was really concerned about class size, about the funding for the school, and at the end of our conversation, I said, well, hey, great talk. Remember to go out and vote. I need everyone's help. And he kind of dropped his head. And he said, Nick, he said, after high school, I got in trouble with methamphetamine. And So I went to treatment now, and I'm better, and I'm home, and I'm here with my wife and my daughter, but I'm a convicted felon. I can't vote. He goes, and don't get me wrong, I'm excited. I'd be excited to vote for you. He said, but I live here, I pay taxes, my daughter is going to school. The school is asking me to help make sure that she has a manageable class size, and I can't vote on behalf of my daughter to have a funded school. And so that struck me. I'll be honest, I tend to be kind of a crime and punishment guy, and that struck me, I think personally. And so I've been supportive of this bill since you and I got in the legislature together, and I wish you the best of luck, and I hope this bill moves forward.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is as much for the community as it is for the people voting. We cannot expect them to follow the rules if they don't have a say in them. And that is a basic fundamental that has been around forever. Why would you expect people to say, I'm going to follow the rules, but I don't have a say? I mean, so this is as much for the community as it is for the felons, and we really need to get behind it. Thank you.
Representative Ostrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Dean, I'm a strong supporter of this proposal. I've been a prosecutor, and I've taken away people's rights to vote. I actually convicted a defendant on Election Day, and he turned to the judge and said, can I please go and vote before you sentence me? And so these folks are in our communities and members. Not every state even takes away the right to vote when they send people to prison. There are at least three states in the country that allow people to vote right in the prison. So this is a choice that a state has on what level of punishment they want to give and what rights they want to take away. Now, while Minnesota is the second or third lowest in incarceration, we are the fourth highest in the country in length of probation. So we punish our people longer. I believe that we want people to participate. We want them to vote. We want them to care about our community. We want them to care about our schools. And one of the ways we do that is to restore their right to vote. And so, Representative Dean, thank you for the work.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A strong supporter as well for all the reasons stated. And I want to make sure just to note, I may have missed this in Representative Dean's opening statement, but I'm a prosecutor as well. And just to confirm, the County Attorneys Association strongly supports this and endorses the bill with that amendment, the repealer removed. And they know, prosecutors know, that this is a pro-public safety, pro-community safety bill. I'm so grateful to you, Representative Dean, that you testified for bringing it forward. And I'd say, Representative Weaver, if you have this essay here, be comfortable watching your arm. This is part of the idea of having folks be involved in our community in all these different ways, and I feel like this is such a strongly pro-public safety and pro-community bill. So many thanks to you.
Okay, members, I am going to, just very briefly, I'm going to be making a motion to lay this bill on the table, because I do have some concerns with it. I understand the need for it, what you're trying to do. I have some current constitutional issues I'm struggling with to see if it actually is constitutional to do by our state constitution. But I am going to allow Representative Dean to have some final statements on this before I do that motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. And, of course, thank you to my testifiers. This is an issue that has been within the legislature for several years now. Minnesota would not be the first state doing something like this. Currently, there are 15 states that allow this, in states such as North Dakota, states such as Indiana. This isn't a progressive or liberal issue or a, you know, Republican or conservative issue. This is an issue about what's doing what's right. The reason that it includes all individuals with felony convictions is because of the way our elections are. Any chance we can create a bright line between who can vote and who can't vote, that actually adds to the integrity of our voting system. And as the recent OLA report came out, Minnesota does it pretty well. We do a really good job, and we need to continue to do things well. The number of individuals that have been found to vote improperly is actually very, 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 very small. And to the point that you could even say that its impact on elections is almost negligible. So I want to thank the chair, and I want to thank you members, and thank those individuals who showed up today for this hearing on the bill. And I, just because I have to ask, Mr. Chair, I would just ask you not to table and maybe just let us go to a voice vote and see what happens. Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to make a motion to lay the bill on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Division.
Division has been called. All those in favor to lay the bill on the table, raise your hand. All those opposed? Eight to seven, the motion to lay the bill on the table is approved. At this time, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you for everybody's